Climate models are tools used by scientists attempting to understand how the climate system would respond to various levels of greenhouse gases. The most recent issue of Environmental Research Letters includes a paper in which a climate model was used to look at the possible response to extremely high levels of such gases. I spoke last week with one of the authors, Dr. Reto Knuti, of the Institute for Atmospheric and Climate Science in Zurich, Switzerland, about the paper and about climate models in general. You've just published a paper in Environmental Research Letters. This looks at an extreme, and as you point out, it's beyond the worst case that even the IPCC looks at.
The idea was really to kind of push the boundaries a bit on these scenarios without saying how likely they were, but say, let's find a scenario that is at the upper end of the range, but still kind of plausible, so meaning not inconsistent with population and economical assumptions. The motivation for this study was really to somehow push the range a bit in the other direction, because the whole world is talking about low emission scenarios and what we could possibly do to save the planet, in a sense that we reduce climate change and we reduce emissions. So there's a lot about technology and political options, but in fact, if we look at the reality, we're basically going the other way. Most of the drivers are continuing. We have high emissions, we have high growth. So it seems to me that some of these discussions about low emission mitigation scenarios are interesting, but they're not necessarily likely to happen, at least if you look at the current political situation. So the motivation was to expand the range of the scenarios a bit so that we kind of get the whole spectrum of what could be happening.
You and your co-authors write that the purpose of this test was to test the linearity of the response to a large greenhouse gas forcing. I have to presume you're looking at the linearity of response of the model. You're not pretending that this gives us an idea of the linearity of the response of the atmosphere.
Well, you're correct that we're testing the model, but of course, if we don't believe that the model has anything to do with the real world, then there is no use of the model. So we would, of course, argue that the model has some resemblance to the true world, because it is built on fundamental physical processes and assumptions that are, at least some of them, are known to be true. So we know how energy is conserved. We know some of the processes quite well. We know something about the water cycle. So some of the fundamental processes, I would argue, are well understood, or at least well enough that we can capture them in the model. Fundamentally, it's of course true that we're always testing the model. By definition, any model is a model and is a simplification of the system. The question is not whether the model is correct in the sense that it's entirely true. The question is whether the model is useful for learning something about the target system.
I don't mean to imply that the model does not resemble reality, but this is really a specific point where one might have problems, in that you're looking at linearity. In other words, to pick a simple kindergarten example, I double the amount of cookies, therefore I can double the amount of kids I can feed cookies to. So you're looking at linearity here, and it's specifically in that situation that the atmosphere, being so complex, might not be linear, and it would not show up in your model.
Oh, sorry, maybe that's a misunderstanding. When we speak about linearity, we're not saying that the climate or the atmosphere is linear. It's not at all. It's very, very complicated. It's chaotic. It has lots of processes. So that's not what's happening. And the model actually shows a lot of things that are not linear at all. The question is really, is the overall a large-scale response of the model reasonably linear with different assumptions on the scenario? So say if we double CO2 in the atmosphere, we get some response pattern of the climate, which may be complicated. The question is now, when we triple CO2 or quadruple CO2, are we going to see a similar pattern of response? It may not be identical, of course, and it probably has a larger magnitude, but is it qualitatively different or is it qualitatively similar? And that relates to this discussion of tipping points in the climate system. So there could be things happening in the system that are really abrupt or really qualitatively different. So changes in the ocean circulation, changes in permafrost and the release of methane, the dieback of the Amazon forest, and so on. So we're trying to see a bit of how likely these unexpected things may be. So we're not saying that everything is linear. It's just whether we can kind of scale the overall response. So the expected trends for moderate scenarios going to persist also in high emission scenarios.
You're saying that there are a lot of nonlinear processes happening. There is chaos, for instance. There are many complexities, but that's all going on inside the model. It's going on inside the atmosphere, so that when you put something in, after all those complexities are done, then the final answer is still linear, that it doesn't go too far one direction or the other.
It's not necessarily linear in all cases, but we find that in many cases it actually is. And that's partly the reason is that we're looking not at very small scales and not very short time scales, but we kind of aggregate the response. The example would be if you're looking at traffic, say, on a highway, it's somehow chaotic. Cars are passing, they're accelerating, and sometimes one car stops because there's an accident. So things are highly, highly chaotic. So if you're trying to predict what a single car would do on a highway, it's virtually impossible. But if you're aggregating all the cars in a sense that you would, for example, say, how many cars are going from Denver to Boulder in a given day, then this response is actually highly predictable. I would probably guess you could predict to within a few percent the total number of cars in a day. And you would even be able to say there's more cars on weekdays and fewer cars on holidays, for instance, because people are not working. So the large scale may be actually quite predictable, whereas the small scale, the individual car, may be not predictable. Or the other example is always, we can't really predict the weather more than a few days in advance. But it's actually extremely likely that 6 months from now, temperatures will be much, much cooler than today because it's going to be winter. So some of the big scales, the summer-winter patterns, are going to be very predictable, even though the short term may not be as predictable.
And yet, to use your analogy, you're on the highway every now and then, it's not often, but every now and then, a bridge collapses. And that's going to throw your calculations of traffic completely out the window. There's the, well, 700-pound gorilla of the climate system, the ocean. What if El Niños or La Niñas become more frequent? We're seeing in California right now how much the ocean affects us. We just had rain in June, according to one meteorologist, sort of the memory of La Niña, which isn't even in the ocean anymore. What if the Arctic Oscillation changes a little bit, the North Atlantic Oscillation, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation? What if one of these things switches over? What if something like that happens?
Well, again, that depends on the scales you're looking at. If you want to know how climate in June in California is changing, then maybe the answer is we really don't know very well because of precisely the effects that you were just describing. But if we're interested in, say, the global mean temperature, which is some kind of the average aggregated change signal that we're expecting over the whole globe, then that might be actually easier to describe. We're saying the very large-scale response. So if you look at continents or whole hemispheres, it's fairly linear. But on smaller scales, it may not be linear. The other argument maybe is if you're talking about the bridge collapsing, there's always a possibility then of what Rumsfeld calls the unknown unknown. So there may be things that we simply don't understand or that we haven't considered yet. And we cannot fundamentally exclude that option. I mean, it's possible that there may be things in the system that may lead to smaller changes, or they may lead to larger changes. But I think that should not be a reason to dismiss the whole effort and say, well, just we're just going to not worry about it or not look at it at all. Any prediction that we make, any model that we have, be it an economic model, be it a weather model, be it whatever, is always associated with some uncertainties. So we have to just be careful and try to understand the uncertainties as well as we can. And that was partly what I tried in this article that you were probably reading. So how do we trust climate prediction? To some degree, I think there's some things we can trust, There's other things we simply don't know, so we should be honest about it, and we should be careful in trying to consider all the uncertainties that we have not characterized yet.
Please understand, I am not trying to denigrate or contradict your work. I enjoy understanding nature, and I'm trying to understand the atmosphere, clouds and winds and storms. Looking at your models is very helpful to me in understanding the atmosphere. At the same time, it's very difficult to understand your models and how you can decide one thing is going one way and not the other.
I perfectly agree. It is often difficult to interpret those models. These models are some of the most complicated models that exist on the planet, probably. So we're talking about 1 million lines of code, of computer code. It's also difficult to understand the results because the amount of data that they produce is very large. You're welcome to ask critical questions. We use the models, in fact, a lot more for understanding than for predictions, even though that may appear different in the media because the predictions are always the things that people are interested in, the things that are most often discussed on TV and in newspapers and so on. But in fact, what climate scientists do is they develop the models mostly to study processes and to understand how things work. And as the models get better, we're understanding more about the system, but we're never understanding everything. Obviously, there's lots of things we still have not understood. The most important point is really that we're not saying that this is now going to happen. And I think we were trying to be careful, but I would like to emphasize it again. We're often being accused of predicting the most dangerous and the most scary stuff. That's not the idea. The idea of this paper was really to test the model response, first of all, but then also explore the range of things that could be possible, that could be plausible. If you have a range of scenarios that is too narrow, then you may quickly become overconfident. So you may think that you're okay just because you haven't considered all the options. So the idea of the scenarios is really not to say necessarily that something is likely to happen. In fact, we would hope that some things are never going to happen. But still, we would develop scenarios on how to respond and maybe how to prepare ourselves if it were going to happen.
Reto, it's been very good speaking with you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And if you have any further questions, I'm happy to talk.
I will be in touch for sure, so I'll plan to talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm speaking with Dr. Reto Knuti. He is with the Institute for Atmospheric and Climate Science in Zurich, Switzerland. For KVMR, I'm Al Stoller.